In this extremely timely book, Oliver reveals how the UK became a hospitable location for oligarchs and kleptocrats from all over the world, a place where they can hide their monies, build respectable reputations on the back of philanthropy and party donations, and influence those in power. From professional facilitators to politicians, Oliver's book asks searing questions about today's political and economic life in the United Kingdom. He is particularly interested in what he calls butlering, which Oliver will no doubt explain to us in greater detail. Oliver is an award-winning author and journalist who specializes in financial crime and in the former Soviet Union, though the canvas on which this particular book is written is really, really global. And he's also the author of the acclaimed Moneyland, a book he published in 2019, on themes that are somewhat similar, but the two books are complementary. And I have to say, having finished Butler to the World just recently, it's a absolutely compelling read that should really have implications, certainly for anyone interested in research in this field. It's a very, very important and revealing book. But it also contains an agenda for civic action. And I think that aspect I find particularly inspirational. So without further ado, I'm going to give the word to Oliver, who's going to, in 15 minutes, present some of the key themes in the book. Then I'll move back here to ask some questions, to discuss a little bit with Oliver. And then sooner rather than later, we're going to open up the discussion to the audience. We also have a very large online audience. I think we have about 330 people registered for this event. And we'll be able to get comments and questions from you and the online audience. I would only ask, I'll repeat this point just before we start our conversation, for those asking questions to be as concise as possible so that we can deal with as many questions as we possibly can. Oliver?
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I feel it's one of those evenings when perhaps it's everyone's instinct is to sit outside the King's Arms with a very cold pint of something. So I'm grateful that you've chosen to come inside. I'd like to say I was in this room before it was fashionable. This used to be the History Library, and I studied here back in the late 1990s, shortly before I moved to Russia. I always had a slight obsession with Russia. And during the period when I was a student, I sort of felt that all I really wanted to do was go and live in Eastern Europe. It was at the time in the 1990s when there was this period of transformation after the end of communism, when it felt like a sort of once in a, I'd like to say once in a lifetime, but sort of more once in a forever chance of witnessing the transformation of a whole half of the continent, which had always been totalitarian or dictatorial or autocratic, into democracies. Rather naively, I felt that if I moved to Russia, I would be able to witness this transformation. So I moved to Russia in 1999. As it turned out, 3 or 4 weeks before I arrived in St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin became prime minister. So instead of witnessing the transformation of Russia into a democracy, I instead witnessed the extinction of the various flickering signs of democracy that had developed in the 1990s. He gradually, as first prime minister and then prime minister again, then president again, still president at time of speaking, extinguished free political parties, free businesses, free media. His sort of extension of state control went surprisingly far. He extinguished free football hooligans, free organized crime. He created what the Kremlin refers to as a vertical of power, this idea that everything is subordinate to the Kremlin. And it was a profoundly depressing experience, really. Very few things about reporting on politics in Russia during the years that I was there were optimistic. And, you know, naturally many Western countries were quite critical of the tendencies that were happening in Russia at the time. American politicians would fly in and lecture the Russians on the development, on what they needed to do and so on, which was, you know, which we dutifully reported, of course, as Western journalists. But there was always this strange sort of backbeat to the journalistic news cycle at the time, which was that every now and then, I mean, it wasn't, you know, every month, but it might be every couple of months or every 3 months, we'd get a call from editors in London who would say, Some Russian guy has just bought a mansion in, you know, North London, biggest house after Buckingham Palace. Who is this guy? Or some Russian guy's just bought a football club. Can you do a quick 800 words of who is this guy? You know, some Russian guy has just given a large amount of money to, I don't know, some particularly notable cause somewhere. Who is this guy? Can you just do a quick article on who he is, where his money came from? And it felt very weird, really, that these people who were, you know, the very close circle around Vladimir Putin, this very small number of very wealthy Russians who'd done very well out of Russia's transformation. And they are a very small number. I mean, Russia remains probably more unequal than any large country. This very small number of people who were in Russia called the oligarchs, they were considered to be the problem. You know, they were the problem. They were what was undermining, you know, democratic transformation. All they had to do, it seemed, was get on a plane and fly to Heathrow, and they were transformed instantly into entrepreneurs or occasionally philanthropists. I don't think they were called wealth creators, but you very much felt that that was in the post. And it was really annoying and sort of hypocritical, really. And a number of us, you know, sort of Russophiles or actual Russians, sort of found this very frustrating, this hypocrisy whereby Russians were treated very differently if they were in Russia or if they were just dispensing largesse in London. And so that's why we created what we called the kleptocracy tours. Kleptocracy tours were a very simple idea. I wish it were my idea, but actually it was my friend Roman Borisovich who came up with it. And the model was the Hollywood tours that you can do in California. And you go in a bus and drive around Hollywood, and so the guide points out, you know, the house that used to belong to Charlie Chaplin or I don't know, pick your film star. They all lived there, obviously, and it's all very exciting, and everyone feels a frisson of nearness to the stars of the silver screen. We did a similar thing, except instead of highlighting the houses that belong to the stars of the silver screen, we pointed out houses that belong to Russian government ministers, oligarchs, and so on. And as we developed the tours and we did more and more of them, we sort of expanded our focus, because of course, London hasn't been providing these kind of wealth management services for questionable fortunes only for Russians. You know, we had Azeris and Kazakhs and Kyrgyz and, you know, Azeris, Georgians, Nigerians, Angolans. It's a target-rich area, West London and North London. I mean, essentially, the area we could cover on our bus was limited only by the attention span of the people on the bus or the traffic on the day. Sometimes, if it's particularly light traffic, we would go up to Highgate and try and see if we could get a glimpse of that particularly large building, Wittenhurst, which belongs to a Russian fertilizer tycoon. We haven't really tested people's patience by going into the home counties, but had we done those, obviously a lot of opportunities for gawping at luxury properties there as well. And because of my role as a sort of guide on the kleptocracy tours, I gained a degree of notoriety among people who were interested in kleptocracy in other countries. And when they came to London, they would often ask me out for a coffee to ask my opinion about what they should be doing. And which is why I ended up with, this is a bit of a shaggy dog story, but there is a point, which is why I ended up chatting to an American academic called Andrew, who was looking into Chinese money laundering. Chinese money laundering is quite different to Russian money laundering because of the different specifics of the Chinese and Russian sort of political and economic setups. But, you know, it has this, the commonality that the money tends to end up or often ends up or moves through London. And Andrew was here in the UK to find out how that worked. And he, the way he was doing this, it rapidly became clear, was he was using me as a springboard to try and find access to people who would know details of investigations into Chinese money laundering that were happening in the UK. So he kept asking me who were the equivalent of people in America who were doing important work. You know, who's the equivalent of the prosecutors in the Southern District of New York? And I'd have to say we don't have anyone like that here. You know, who's the equivalent of, I don't know, the Department of Justice's kleptocracy unit? And I'd say, well, we don't have anyone like that either. You know, who's Homeland Security investigations? Who's bringing those kind of cases against, you know, in, you know, wealthy criminal immigrants? So, yeah, again, we don't have that. And it became embarrassing after a while, because it felt a little bit like I recently read my children the 1001 Nights, and there's that story of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves when his brother is trying to get into the magic cave, and he knows that the password is a foodstuff. He doesn't know it's open sesame, so he keeps saying, so open lentil, open chickpea and things, and it keeps not opening. And it felt a bit like Andrew was just naming American institutions until eventually the magic cave of my contact book would open, and I would reveal all these people tackling money laundering in Britain. And eventually I had to say, look, I'm sorry, we don't have any of those people. That is just a sector of society that exists not. And I was trying to explain why this wasn't happening. I said, because in America, you do this. You're like the policeman to the world. You enforce your law on the rest of the world. But in Britain, we don't feel the need to do that. We're not the policeman to the world. And I was like, well, what are we? You know, if we're not the policeman to the world, what's Britain? And the image that came to mind was a consigliere in a mafia movie. The kind of person who sits next to the Don in the back room of an Italian restaurant in Brooklyn in a sort of white vest eating spaghetti. But that's obviously not a British thing and not a British stereotype. So I put that aside. What is it? It's butler. You know, it's a butler, somebody who stands there immaculately dressed, you know, proffering advice when it's asked for, getting people out of scrapes. I did actually, after I had this idea, Andrew left in a degree of disappointment, I think, to what I was prepared to provide. But I sat there thinking about this and thought, this is actually quite interesting, because it's not just a metaphorical butler. Britain's actually big in the literal butler business. We are the leading provider of butlers to oligarchs around the world. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go and join an actual butler class. They're training schools all over the place. And so I did. For a morning, I was a trainee butler. Only lasted a morning. I think they realized quite quickly that I wasn't actually there to learn how to be a butler, but rather to try and reveal the whole butler industry. So I wasn't invited back. But while I was there, I was talking to a very nice Canadian trainee butler. And I asked her why, while we were at flower arranging, why... I was actually quite good at it. It was like a basket. Anyway, I forgot afterwards. It didn't stick. But why is this butler demand? Why does everyone want butlers? And she said... it's obvious, isn't it? Everyone wants their own Jeeves. I was like, ha, of course, that's it. Everyone wants a Jeeves. A Jeeves, because, and I did actually read all of the Jeeves and Worcester books. There are 5 volumes of them. If you haven't read them, but presumably most people here know, it's such an educated crowd, you'll know Jeeves and Worcester. Jeeves is the fictional valet of a fictional posh Bullingdon twat called Bertie Worcester. And Bertie Worcester's always getting into scrapes, caused by his own idiocy or the idiocy of his friends or relatives. And Jeeves is always extricating him by the use of his enormous brain. Jeeves is essentially, you know, endlessly competent and could be anything, but instead chooses to earn money by helping Bertie Worcester get out of scrapes. And some of the scrapes and some of the tricks he has to use to get Bertie Worcester out of scrapes are genuinely savage. Like he sort of perverts the course of justice, he impersonates police officers, he bribes police officers, he assaults a police officer at one point, and in his own words, it felt the best course of action, sir, to avoid any unpleasantness, which is an unusual thing to say. It certainly wasn't unpleasant for the police officer. But anyway, so Jeeves, this is what we've become. And it became, I suppose, because I'm a Russianist, my instinct was this is a post-Soviet story. This is a post-Soviet transformation, right? But actually, if you look at just the most obvious Russian scams which have involved British involvement, there was a particularly notable one that Vladimir Putin was involved in. He kind of came to public attention by shutting down an investigation in the late 1990s before he was prime minister, even when he was still head of the FSB, their main internal security service. That predated the end of the Soviet Union. There were Soviet dirty money was moving through London and the British offshore territories before 1991. And if that was moving through here, then clearly this isn't a post-Soviet problem. This is something that long predates it. And that, I mean, that's obvious with a moment's thought if you lift the perspective up from the former Soviet Union to other places. Nigerian kleptocratic money has obviously been coming through London or flowing through British offshore territories since the 1960s and really picked up in the 1970s. Money from the Gulf, money from South America, money from the Far East, from Malaysia, Indonesia, and so on, has been coming here in huge quantities since way before 1991. The pace may have picked up with liberalization in Russia and then China, but clearly the problem predates the end of the Soviet Union by a long time. And the longer I looked into this, the more it occurred to me that this is essentially a post-imperial story, that becoming a butler, by becoming a sort of servant to the world's oligarchs, is essentially what Britain became when it ceased to be the world's oligarch on its own account. A sort of bankrupt Britain after the Second World War could no longer afford to impose its will on foreign countries in the manner that Vladimir Putin is currently imposing his will on Ukraine. But we still knew how to do it. We just couldn't afford to do it anymore. So we started advising foreign oligarchs in how to be, you know, thievers, sorry, is that a word, of other people's property rather than doing it on our own account. If you are an aristocrat and you've lost your big house, but you still know how to behave like an aristocrat, there is a lot of money to be made in being a butler for other people. And there is this key moment, which I think is crucial to understand the transformation of Britain into a place that sells services to the wealthy of other countries, no matter where their money comes from. And that was in 1955. It was at a time when the world worked in a very different way to how it works now. The post-war system, the Bretton Woods system, which I'm sure many of you are aware of, severely limited how money could move between countries. The Allies at the end of the Second World War felt that the unrestrained capital flows of the interwar period had been a key contributing factor in the instability that led to the rise of fascism throughout continental Europe and elsewhere. And in order to try and allow democracy to cement itself in the post-war period, they needed to really restrict these capital flows to allow countries a degree of stability and to get a chance to build democracy in the post-war, particularly in post-war Europe. And this was very successful. You know, unrestricted economic growth all across the Western world throughout, you know, the 1950s and 1960s. But it was very annoying if you were very wealthy because taxes were extremely high. It was a deliberate part of this policy was to have punitive taxation rates on the very wealthy. You know, it's kind of amazing to think about it, but, you know, marginal tax rates of 95, 97% were not that unusual in Western countries at the time. And it was also very unusual, very annoying, this system for the City of London. The City of London had been the economic motor of the British Empire, but as the British Empire drifted away, more and more countries became independent. More and more countries turned to using the US dollar as their main currency of transactions rather than sterling, and the City of London became sort of moribund. It's actually quite amazing to read oral histories of the City of London from the 1950s, because it's so utterly different to what the city is like now. There's this, one of my favorite anecdotes in one of these oral histories is a guy who used to work in a bank, and on his lunch break, him and a friend used to get on a boat to go to Greenwich. It wasn't like these fast catamarans that go up and down the Thames now. This was a real tramp steamer. And they would chug down to Greenwich, drinking beer the whole way and eating sandwiches, and chug all the way back again. The whole round trip would take sort of 3.5 hours. And by the time they got back, they'd be barely able to stand. They'd be so drunk, and no one in the office would have noticed they'd gone because there was just absolutely nothing going on. There were still entrepreneurial people in the city who were keen to change this very sort of moribund status quo. And importantly for our purposes and for the purpose of this story, there were two banks who really felt that were very much chafing at the restrictions imposed by the Bretton Woods system. One was the Midland Bank, a high street bank in the UK, but a small one, one that was really struggling to break into the big time because of the restrictions imposed on lending rates that it could charge. And the other was the Moskovsky Narodny Bank, a Soviet-owned institution that was based in London, and which was banking the Soviet Union's dollars because the Soviet Union felt that keeping its dollars in New York was unwise because they could be frozen at a time of geopolitical tension. And the Midland Bank wanted to raise capital so it could fund more lending, and the Moskovsky Narodny Bank wanted to do something with these dollars it was keeping in London. And they realized that if the Moskovsky Narodny Bank lent its dollars to the Midland Bank, then it was beneficial for both of them, because the Midland would have money it could essentially use to fund lending, and the Moskovsky Narodny Bank could earn an interest rate that was illegal in the US, where there were strict limits on the lending rate that could be charged by banks. So they sort of did this little trade between themselves, and that wouldn't really have amounted to very much had the year later there been the Suez Crisis. And because of the Suez Crisis and the humiliation that followed when the US really put very strong pressure on the UK to pull out of Egypt, the sterling froze essentially as an international currency. There was this real massive sterling crisis. And the banks in London were desperately looking around for a new way of funding the trade that they funded. And they picked up on this idea that the Midland and Moskovsky Narodny Bank had done. And they started using dollars to lend out too. And when they did that, they made an amazing discovery, a world-changing discovery. I think possibly one of the most important discoveries of the second half of the 20th century, which was that if you use dollars in the City of London, British rules didn't apply because the British rules applied only to sterling. And American rules didn't apply either because American rules only applied in the United States. So these very strict limitations on the movement of money around the world, which applied, you know, universally and really restricted the interest rates that could be charged and how money could be moved around, just didn't apply. They had invented an entirely rules-free space just by using dollars in London. And all of the networks of the British Empire, which had previously moved sterling around the world, were repurposed to move dollars. And these dollars were could move freely. And moving money freely without limits, without having to do any compliance, any of the things banks have to do, is a very profitable thing to do. Basically, that's how, you know, the City of London is reborn as a banking center, by moving dollars. And they needed a term for this legal space they'd created, because they had to keep two sets of books. One, the boring old sterling denominated transactions. Two, these exciting buccaneering rules-free transactions. What do you call a space with no rules? Well, there is a legal concept which existed at the time. That's what happens if you get in a boat and you voyage out to sea away from the territorial jurisdiction of any government. That's called offshore. And this is where offshore comes from. This is the invention of offshore. And if you look at what they were doing, they were allowing the owners of money, any money, the Soviet Union, our geopolitical foe, to evade the restrictions placed on them by other governments. In that case, the United States, our closest ally. We were making money, earning fees from allowing the Soviet Union to dodge restrictions placed on its activities by the United States. And this market grew enormously from about $4 billion a year in the beginning of the 1960s to $40 billion by the end of the 1960s. The offshore dollar market in London is now worth about $3 trillion a year. It's by far the biggest market in the world. But really, all dollars are now offshore. It became so big that the onshore restrictions collapsed under the weight of this capital flows because all the banks moved to London. Because what was the point of banking anywhere else? When you had to go somewhere else, you had restrictions in Germany or France or Japan or the US. So they came here. So all the other countries reduced their restrictions too, and money was able to move freely. The post-war Bretton Woods system designed to limit the movement of money, to create stability, to allow governments to build democracy safe from the sort of speculative fervor of the owners of wealth, that collapsed too, and we ended up with the world that we don't have, that we have now. And this is the story of the growth of kleptocracy, really. Kleptocracy, not just in Russia and Ukraine and Azerbaijan, but in many of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa, in many of the countries of the Far East, of South Asia, and so on. In that all of the elites of these countries have been able to move money through and to spend money in London, unchecked, unregulated, because this is how London now makes its money, with astonishing and huge impacts on our country and how our country has changed, and also, above all, on the rest of the world. So that's what I mean by being a butler to the world. Butlering is these services whereby we earn fees by helping anyone who can afford to pay them to evade the restrictions imposed by other countries. And you know, what is butlering? Well, butlering is about far more than just moving money unhindered. It's about investing that money. It's about hiding the origins of that money. It's about using defamation proceedings to attack journalists who might reveal the origins of that money. It's about being able to sue the owners of that money in British courts. It's about, and my favorite example is one that was exposed after the book came out by the researchers of Alexei Navalny, the Russian anti-corruption activist, who revealed that the Scheherazade, the biggest, actually talking about the Arabian Nights, the Scheherazade, the biggest at the time super yacht of unclear ownership anywhere in the world, he revealed that it probably belonged to Vladimir Putin. And he had a crew manifest. Every single member of the crew of the Scheherazade worked for the Kremlin's guard service, the sort of secret service that protects the president of the Russian Federation, except for one, the captain. And he was, of course, British, because they always are. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Oliver. Let me start with a question about one of the things that is most striking about your book is the speed with which some of your lead characters in the book, some of these Russian, Ukrainian oligarchs, get to the very heart of the British establishment. They do so in real time. They're still disreputable back in the former Soviet space. They may be even undergoing investigations in the United States as one of the main characters in your book. In the UK, they will be seeing royalty. They will be donors to political parties. They will be using blue chip facilitators, the leading law firms, the leading banks. They will become important donors to leading cultural institutions, think tanks. The question is, how could this happen?
It's true. There's a sort of, it's like being in an airport when you have one of these fast track immigration lines, if you're prepared to pay for it. There's a sort of fast track immigration line that most people, you know, they have to get a visa and then live here for a generation or two before anyone's prepared to accept that they're actually British. If you can pay money, then it just takes you 2 or 3 years, really. I mean, the example I write about in the book is a gentleman called Dmitry Firtash, a Ukrainian gas tycoon who made a fortune by working with Gazprom, Vladimir Putin's gas company, to sell gas to Ukraine. It's a tool of Russian foreign policy. He made a very large fortune doing this, far more money than he could spend in Ukraine. So he brought the money here, and that was in 2007. And within 4 years, thanks to the generous donations he'd given to another university, I believe it's somewhere in the Fens, he was welcomed to the Guild of Benefactors of Cambridge University. He had been introduced to the Duke of Edinburgh, who there's this astonishing photo of him shaking the hand of the Duke of Edinburgh wearing his long red robes. He'd been given a special medal for his outstanding philanthropy. He bought himself a mansion in central London. It's one of those sort of iceberg mansions that has as much under the surface as it does above the surface. If you look on the plans, on the planning portal, which you can look up, you can see it has a swimming pool about 10 meters underground. It's extraordinary. He got to open trading on the London Stock Exchange. He was welcomed into the House of Commons to meet the Speaker of Parliament. All of these things, because and he'd set up the British Ukrainian Society with several members of the House of Lords and the House of Commons, you know, associated with it on the board or helping him, which essentially to ease his passage into the British establishment. So it's amazing that when his big business coup happened in 2006, when Russia cut off the gas supply to Ukraine because Ukraine was objecting to the very high prices that it wanted to charge, when the Ukrainian government backed down and so Mr. Firtash made his first big fortune. No one knew what he looked like. No one knew who he was. Global Witness, the campaigning investigative organization, wrote a report about the gas trade, and all they had was the shape of a person with a question mark instead of a photo, because no one knew what he looked like. But within 4 years, he's hanging out with the Duke of Edinburgh. With another 2 years, he's in Parliament opening trading on the London Stock Exchange. And this is sort of the most amazing two facts, that when crisis broke out in Ukraine again, as it did in the winter of 2013 to 14, the huge protest that became the Euromaidan revolution, the president of Ukraine flees, and Vladimir Putin annexes Crimea. The government is so keen to know what to do that they ask Mr. Firtash in to give them advice. And Firtash's advice is that this is all the Americans' fault and that they shouldn't, you know, impose any sanctions on Russia. And then we sold him a tube station, which is amazing. I think he's the only private owner of a tube station, certainly in London, possibly in the world. It was a disused tube station. It was used by the Ministry of Defense as an office, but it's still got all the platforms, the shafts, everything. It's kind of amazing. I haven't been in it myself, but I have friends who've been down to the platform level. It's just, you know, extraordinary. It still looks like a tube station. It's got that kind of weird, you know, shiny purple tiles that you get on the front of old tube stations. And it is an amazing demonstration of our willingness to buckler for anyone who can afford our services, that we integrated him into our establishment so fast and provided him with all the sort of, you know, reputation management services that he needed. And the contrast with us and the Americans, as I was saying, the Americans are the policemen of the world, is that while this was happening, this whole time, the FBI was investigating him and the trades he'd been involved in. And 2 weeks after we sold him the tube station, the Americans indicted him on corruption charges. And he's been stuck in Vienna battling extradition ever since. So he's never got to enjoy his tube station. It's just sitting there, unused, poor chap. We used to feature him on the kleptocracy tours. He was he was always my favorite, because I used to talk about him. He was always my favorite character. His house was my favorite, because every time we turned up, he'd call the police, or whoever was in there. He wasn't in there, he was in Vienna. Whoever was in there would call the police. And so they would do it. Yeah, because the problem is, if you're doing a kleptocracy tour, it's just a house, right? I mean, it's on Belgrave Square. It might belong to Leo Deripaska, but it's still just a house, like any other house on Belgrave Square. So this was more fun, because you'd turn up and stand outside, and then the police would come. And then we'd have to explain who we were, and that was more fun. So we liked him for that.
Oliver, in the book, you survey British regulatory capacity in the financial sector, and also law enforcement capacity. And the picture you paint is absolutely appalling. And I work on these things, but even reading the way you've pinned this down, I have one example here that really struck me. The Command and Control Center of the National Crime Agency, which is one of the crucial entities in this regard, loses its entire workforce every 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, not
that's the turnover. Yeah. The salaries are bad.
Yeah.
People are demoralized. And law enforcement and financial regulation in the UK are completely outgunned, especially in terms of the high-quality legal services that these oligarchs are able to bring into any minor confrontation. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about
that? Yeah, so our law enforcement and regulatory bodies are both badly designed and underfunded. It's a sort of spectacular double whammy of failure. The National Crime Agency, the Serious Fraud Office, the Metropolitan Police, City Police, who are the sort of lead agencies for tackling financial crime, are, I mean, almost hilariously underfunded compared to the resources that are put in place by the oligarchs to defend their wealth. Even small things that can be done. I mean, the company's house, our corporate registry, which is, you know, registers thousands of companies every day, and it has been for a long time the leading provider of the shell companies that have laundered money out of the former Soviet Union in huge quantities. The really big money laundering scandals like Danske Bank and Swedbank and so on have all been hidden behind British shell companies. You know, that is, you could go online while I'm talking, create a company in 15 minutes. It costs you £12. No one checks the information you provide. It is a dreadful system. And then that is about lack of resourcing. You know, it is technically a criminal offence to create a company and lie on the documents. But it's incredibly unusual for anyone to be prosecuted. The only prosecution that I know of is a man called Kevin Brewer, who created companies in politicians' names to show them how easy it was to create fake companies. And he was then prosecuted for creating fake companies, which is genuinely insane. It's alarming. I mean, but then there's also the poor structure of the system. You know, we do have anti-money laundering regulators who are supposed to check our enabling industries, you know, the lawyers, the accountants, and so on. But we have 26 of them. Most countries have 3 at most. We have 26. This fragmented, just for accountants, there are 8 different anti-money laundering regulators, and they can pick and choose between them at will. If you're being regulated by one and you don't like it, you can just move to another one, which is a little bit like, you know, playing football. And if you don't like the referee's decision, you can just go and move to a different pitch. And in that case, the referee wouldn't earn a salary. So obviously, the referee isn't going to be too strict in imposing the offside rule. My favorite, if that's the word, of our anti-money laundering regulators is the Faculty Office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, which has been regulating notaries public, who is a sort of rather withered branch of the legal profession since the 16th century, as a result of the divorce deal cooked up for Henry VIII. If the fact that a part of our anti-money laundering regulatory system exists because of Thomas Cromwell's divorce deal for Henry VIII, we know that this is not a system that was designed. It's just something that, like so many things in the British Constitution, we've just sort of stumbled into in a kind of will this do sort of way. And as a result, money laundering isn't stopped. You know, according to the estimate of the National Crime Agency, and it's very much a kind of finger in the air estimate, £100 billion with a B, is laundered through the City of London every year. I mean, maybe it's bigger than that, maybe it's smaller. We don't know. That's just a 1 with 8 zeros after it. But it's an incredible amount of money. And every single one of those pounds has been stolen from countries that desperately need them to be moved through a country that frankly doesn't. And that is, it's a national scandal, and I really don't understand why it doesn't get more attention.
Oliver, tell us a little bit about the difficulties of doing work in this field, and in particular, the role of lawyers in limiting scrutiny of oligarchs and their facilitators. We've seen in the media a number of journalists, Catherine Belton, Tom Burgess, yourself, that have undergone lawsuits. Could you tell us a bit about the legal profession in the UK and the role it plays in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, we have very strict rules around defamation in this country, also very strict rules around data protection, which are in some ways even worse. And they do make it very hard to write about oligarchs and write about the very wealthy. It's interesting talking to American journalists about the stories that they've not been able to publish. And they'll say, oh, I had this, you know, this tip-off, but I never managed to stand it up. You know, I never managed to publish it because I couldn't nail down the facts. Whereas in Britain, I regularly talk to people, oh, yes, it's nailed on. I had a whistleblower, I had all the documents, all the information, but I couldn't publish it because of the risk of being sued. And it isn't... But saying it's just the fault of the lawyers is understating how pernicious this system is, because that makes it sound like that I have somewhere a drawer of stories that are ready to go, that I've written and prepared, and they're all ready. And if you just change the law, I'd be able to sort of send them all out on Twitter and everything would be great. Because it isn't just the lawyers that stop you. Because the first step is, I think, well, will I ever be able to get this published? And if the answer is no, I'm not even going to bother starting the research into an article. And if I do think I might be able to get it published, I take it to an editor and I say, will you commission this? And the editor, he might think, or she might think, I'm never going to get this published, never going to get this through the lawyers, so they won't commission it. And then the lawyers, if I manage to think it's a good idea and the editor agrees, Then I write it, the editor approves it, we take it to the lawyer, and then the lawyer will say, no, there's no point because we might get sued. Then and only then, if it goes through those three stages, might it be published, at which point we might actually get sued. So, and the extent to which this self-censoring happens, and it is censoring. You know, I was talking to a friend who works for one of our national broadcasters that recently did a film on one of the big oligarchs. They'd had that film on file for 3 years, and they only ran it because of the sanctions that had been put in. It had been sitting there for ages. They hadn't had any legal letters about it. They were just worried that they might get sued, so they never published it. You know, but this sense of self-censorship reaches almost absurd levels sometimes. I have a friend who wrote a book about a giant financial fraud, the Malaysian 1MDB scam. And he wrote a book about it, Billion Dollar Whale. It's a very good book. And he couldn't get it published in this country because the main protagonist in the fraud had hired a British law firm to basically threaten British publishers, British distributors, and so on, with legal action if the book ever was published. The book finally was published after about a year. The very brave small publishing house took on the risk of publishing it here, and fortunately nothing came of it. It was absolutely fine. And I wrote an article about the fact that it had been finally published. And the law firm, acting on behalf of the protagonist of the book, was able to threaten that publication, and the article about the book being published was never published. Even though I wasn't writing about the original crime, I hadn't said almost anything at all. I was just writing the process of how difficult it is to publish a book in the face of legal pressure. But it didn't matter. The editor was so risk-averse that the article was never happened. And it's almost a meta-censorship. It was a censorship of an article about censorship. And that's the difficulties. I mean, look, I don't want to overstate how this, it's annoying, but I mean, it's not like journalists in Azerbaijan who are put in prison or journalists in Russia who are killed. It's not that bad. But it does mean, it does limit the amount of information that is out there. And this has a sort of vicious circle effect because, you know, in other countries, when journalists are able to publish articles about corruption and financial crime, that can then provoke police investigations or law enforcement investigations, which will then in turn inform other journalistic investigations, and you end up with this cycle whereby more and more information gets out there. But the fact that there's this constant sand in the wheel of publications means that the police don't have the raw material they need, or due diligence information's working when the financial services industry don't have the information they need. So essentially more and more people are able to get away with financial crime who wouldn't be able to otherwise. And it is a bonkers situation and a very annoying one.
So Oliver, you've written Moneyland, this book is impeccable timing, but until February, the people in the UK who were interested in this sort of cluster of issues, yourself, a couple of campaigning investigative organizations, 3 weeks ago we had Margaret Hodge MP and Andrew Mitchell MP who've been championing this agenda, but with the Russian-Ukrainian invasion of Ukraine, this really has come into the mainstream. But there's a curiously focused character to the British debate. It's about Russian kleptocrats and the laundering of Russian money. It seems to me, I come at this, as you know, from a more African perspective, that we're not really having a systemic conversation. There's no Nigeria, there's no Angola, there's certainly no Persian Gulf in this conversation. And yet the mechanisms, there's no Chinese money laundering conversation, but the mechanisms that elites from the world over use to launder their monies and their reputations in the UK they're not similar, they're exactly the same. Yeah. And the service providers are the ones you described in your presentation.
The same people. Yeah.
Exactly, the same individuals. What do you make of that for the chances of real structural reform in the UK?
It's the response to the Ukraine crisis and the invasion of Ukraine, I think, has revealed two very interesting phenomena in Britain. One of which is this, it's very reactive. You know, you ended up with a crisis and all of the oligarchs' assets were frozen. But those assets were the same assets 4 or 5 months ago, earned in the same way, moved here in the same way, spent on the same things. They're the same people. What changed was there was a geopolitical crisis. So that was not a law enforcement decision. There was no law enforcement decision there. This is a political decision made in response to a political crisis. And that is what we see again and again and again. There's no proactive law enforcement response to financial crime. We're not saying we're not freezing, you know, for example, the case in America with Dmitry Firtash. They investigated him because they felt he'd broken the law, and they got an indictment in with the grand jury in Chicago, and they unsealed the indictment, and they've been trying to extradite him. In this country, it is entirely a response to what Vladimir Putin did. So this is a foreign policy decision. It's been presented as a law enforcement decision, but there's no law enforcement aspect to it. And we don't really know what the sanctions are intended to achieve. It's never really been explained. Do they exist purely to deny these assets to Vladimir Putin's government? Or are they supposed to be, we keep hearing these ludicrous gimmicks being thrown out by the government, like, Michael Gove came up with this idea that we could repurpose these oligarchs' properties to house Ukrainian refugees. That was what, two months ago, and mysteriously nothing more has been heard of that. And it's so there's this sort of kind of planless, clueless government response to a crisis. But there have been specific actions taken and specific actions promised, which I think elucidate a second point, which is equally important, which is that the government did pass back in January, a government minister resigned at the dispatch box in the House of Lords because of the lack of action on economic and financial crime. Lord Agnew, so disgusted, he resigned in response. After the Ukraine crisis, however, we got very quickly an Economic Crime Act, intending to impose transparency on shell companies that own property in the UK and do a couple of other sort of technical changes to unexplained wealth orders and other things. And now we're promised a new economic crime bill, which would supposedly clean up companies' house. So yes, the government is doing something great, and the government is able to stand up and say, look at all these world-leading activities that we've undertaken. But there's no extra resources to enforce these rules. There's no extra money for the National Crime Agency. They've announced the creation of KCEL, the kleptocracy unit within the National Crime Agency, but there already was an international corruption unit. It's just a rebranding of the same thing. There's no new people, there's no new money, there's no new political top cover for this. Instead, you have a new law has been passed, and that's the sum total of everything. I mean, we had Margaret Hodge and Andrew Mitchell managed to force through during the Theresa May premiership, managed to force through an amendment that imposed transparency on our tax havens, the British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, and so on, which is important and valuable. But there's no new resources been made available to these places to allow them to implement the law. The law was passed, and that's the problem solved from the government's perspective. And this is a sort of almost performative method of government. I keep trying to think of a mechanism, of a metaphor to describe what this is. You see it in environmental regulation as well. Last year, an Environment Act is passed, but there's no resourcing for the Environment Agency to allow it to enforce it. You see it in all sorts of different spheres. And it feels a little bit like, I don't know whether when you were kids, you had one of these steering wheels that you could stick to the back of the driver's seat when you were a child, and you could, steer and beep, beep, and like drive as if you were driving the car. And it feels a bit like this is what the government's doing. Boris Johnson, there's a beep, beep, beep. But they're not attached to the wheels. It's not actually changing the direction of the car or making it go faster or slower or doing anything at all. It just looks like he's driving. Or in fact, this just occurred to me. I was watching a making-of documentary of the last Bond film. Not the last Bond film, the last but one. Miss Moneypenny driving a Land Rover around the streets of Istanbul and like around the corners. And it was, incredibly dramatic. But on the roof, there was the guy who played the Stig from Top Gear, who had his own steering wheel, who was actually driving the car. And it feels a bit like that we've got, Liz Truss is Miss Moneypenny. She's not actually cheap, but it doesn't actually take her hands off the wheel. The car would still go wherever it's going. And it feels a bit like that, really, that they pass these laws, but they don't, because they don't provide any extra resources for the agencies tasked with enforcing these laws. Nothing actually changes, but they get the headlines in the newspapers. And then next month, we're all forgotten about Ukraine. We'll all be talking about something else. I think that's probably what they're counting on.
That's a powerful corrective, because there's some optimism in certain quarters that we've turned the corner and that things will have to change.
I was quite optimistic, actually, a couple of months ago. I did feel like, wow, look, they've got it. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. But then they've actually cut the funding for the International Corruption Unit from 5.3 to 5 million pounds. Which is extraordinary. Just recently. It's extraordinary. I did a talk at the Wimbledon Book Festival last night, and after I came out, a woman came up who works for one of the enforcement agencies. I won't say which one, she said, thanks very much for what you were saying. Everything you were saying is completely fits with my own experience of working in this area. And I was saying, well, is there anything that you think I should be writing about? Not individual stories, obviously, but themes, things I'm not talking about, things I should cover. And she said, just keep talking about how we're just so few of us. That's all. We're just so few of us. We're trying so hard, and there are so few of us. And there's this astonishing quote in the report by Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee into Russian interference in the UK, which was published in 2020. Boris Johnson tried to prevent it being published, in fact, did succeed in having it suppressed until after the general election in 2019. But eventually it was published. And there's this amazing quote from Lynn Owens, the director of the National Crime Agency. For the record, the woman I was talking to yesterday was not Lynn Owens, director, ex-director of the National Crime Agency now, but she then ran it. And in which she was asked in the report, why don't you do more to tackle oligarchs? And she said, quote, I am bluntly concerned about the impact on our budget. You can't tackle oligarchs like that. These are rich, resourceful people who will defend their property with everything they've got.
And the sorry tale of the unexplained wealth borders, yeah, as a mechanism that looked promising, but which...
Yeah, I mean, it's another, you know, optimistic ruling. Yeah. You know, after the... they were proposed before the Salisbury poisoning. In fact, the law passed before the Salisbury poisoning, but they were always associated with it because they came into force around the same time. And they also came into force around the time that McMafia was on the television. So they were called the McMafia laws. And they were talked up by government ministers, and we were going to finally drive the oligarchs out of the country. And they are an important mechanism. You know, they're actually quite a draconian mechanism in that if a judge imposes an unexplained wealth order on your property, then instead of the law enforcement agencies having to prove that it's criminal, you have to prove that it's not. And it's a pretty good thing for cutting through the sort of offshore obfuscation of shell companies and so on that oligarchs are so good at hiding behind. But because they never provided enough resources to the National Crime Agency to use them, the first time that they were used really properly in anger against a proper politically connected person from a kleptocracy, the daughter of the former president of Kazakhstan, Dariga Nazarbayeva, the NCA's case just totally fell apart. They were humiliated. Her lawyers, Mishkonda Rea, very powerful law firm, very resourceful and very good at their job. And they just ripped the National Crime Agency's case apart. And it fell apart. And they haven't used one since. That was it. It's done. You know, the hole in their budget, they were left with costs of £1.5 million. The hole in their budget was so huge that, you know, that was it. But what's awful is that this doesn't appear to have been anticipated. If you read the impact assessment of unexplained wealth orders published by the Home Office before this happened, they anticipated that the cost of using them over a decade would be £1.5 million. And yet they lost that much money in the costs of the other side in a single case. That's not taking... Which they lost. That's not taking into account their own costs. They haven't used them since on a politically exposed person. They use them on organized criminals.
Oliver, we'll have about 25 minutes of questions with the audience. I just wanted to ask you very briefly a final question before we open the floor. You mentioned the Firtash case in Cambridge, and I think it's obvious from your book, although this is not the focus of your book, but it's obvious that the search for respectability through philanthropy to cultural institutions, sports clubs, but also think tanks in universities plays an important role in these elite trajectories.
Yeah.
We're here in a university setting. What can you tell us?
Well, I mean,
what's your message to us?
Let's not pretend this is new. I mean, Mr. Rhodes still is just up the road, but there are many things that makes Britain very attractive as a place to put your money. You know, we have this unrivaled cluster of corruption services available in the City of London. There's this argument that if we didn't do it, somebody else will. But that's not true, because there is nowhere else that could do it. The only country that can rival what Britain can provide is the United States. And the United States has the FBI, so it can't do what we can do. You know, yes, bits and bobs of what we can do. There are good private schools in Switzerland. And there's, you know, places to hide your money in Switzerland, but they don't have the wealth management services, the defamation laws, the useful and biddable legal system, the international language. Britain has it all, the whole sort of panoply of services. But I think one thing that we also have, to answer your question, is this very long tradition in our institutions, and this sort of very long, this long and well-established good cultural capital of the aristocracy, which, you know, and the fact that you can read about it, and you see it in Downton Abbey, you can read about it in Jane Austen. And what we're selling is essentially membership of the aristocracy. That's it. We are transforming oligarchs into aristocrats. And this, again, this isn't a new thing. The present Duke of Westminster's father, who I believe was also, while alive, called the Duke of Westminster, which is uncanny. But he used to, when he filled in those, origin of wealth things, he used to write, because he was very witty, and very knowing. Origin of Wealth, Pillage, right? Because it was, right? You know, his family came over here with the Duke of Normandy in 1066, killed all the locals and stole everything. But that was 1,000 years ago, and that's fine now, you know. But what in the old days, it used to take a while, you know, to go to respectability. You know, I mean, you could go to India. I mean, it's essentially what the oligarchs are doing is what Brits used to do in India, right? You'd steal everything from India, come back here, build a big house, and then in a generation or two, you're the lord of something or other. But what people want is just that process, but just in 5 years. You know, we want integration into the Downton Abbey class within 5 years. So you come over here, you buy your house in Eaton Square, you buy your mansion in the home counties, you buy your super yacht. And I mean, look, we have the son of a Russian oligarch in the House of Lords. I mean, look, this is literal integration to the aristocracy. It's kind of amazing. And it doesn't really get as much attention as I think it deserves.
Thank you, Oliver. And we're going to open the floor. A couple of things. We're going to have, you can buy the book outside. There's also drinks at 6:15. So keep that in mind. When you're asking your question, I'd ask you to introduce yourself and to keep it brief, because we want as many of you to be able to share views.
Unless you're really interesting.
Exactly. In which case you can go on.
Yeah, no pressure.
So I'm going to ask this gentleman here.
Oh, wait.
Sorry, my name is John Barrows. I think your book is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
To what extent do you think that the lack of will to investigate the Russian oligarchs was linked with the contributions to over many years to the Conservative Party? And also, in relation to Abramovich, most of the things that we now know were known at the time of the litigation against Berezovsky. Could you just explain why it was that absolutely zero seemed to have happened between then and the invasion?
Thank you.
So with regard to the first question about funding of the Conservative Party, I'm not really a believer in conspiracies, to be honest. And, you know, there's this sort of always this dichotomy between, you know, cock up or conspiracy. I always think that we need a third option, because what you end up with is something which is accidentally discovered, which is so beneficial to enough people that no one has any incentive to change it. And we don't have a word for whatever that is, that concept. But I think that that explains far more than either cock-up or conspiracy. I don't think that the Conservative Party is doing what it's doing or was so sort of sluggish about acting in regard to Russian money because of Russian donations to the Conservative Party. Because to be honest, the Labour government was just as bad as they now, as people like Liam Byrne will now admit. And the Tory government before them were just as bad as well. This has been a long-term thing that long predates the gifts of these wealthy Russian origin people to the Tory party. I don't think that we have a Russian money problem. I think we have a money problem, which goes far deeper than a Russian money problem. And I think a lot of it goes back to the origins of offshore finance in the 1950s and 60s, which is, you know, what was London offering? You know, what was London's, you know, unique selling point as a rival to Wall Street, which is where the business had been? What London was less regulated. That was it. It was the only thing we had to offer was the fact that we could do what they could do cheaper because we didn't have any rules. And I think there has been this long-term reluctance to impose rules on money in Britain because out of fear that it will just go back to America and then we'll end up with nothing. And there is a story I tell in the book, which if you read it, you'll know, which is about the Scottish Limited Partnership, this very niche legal structure. It's not a shell company because it's a limited partnership, but it works in the same way. And it was used to launder money out of the Soviet Union by the tens of billions, if not the hundreds of billions. And this was revealed by some very good journalists and campaigned on by some very good, tenacious Scottish politicians who really wanted this because it was a real stain on Scotland's reputation, but they needed to change the law at Westminster. And the Treasury didn't change the law out of concern that it would drive the private fund industry elsewhere to Luxembourg or Delaware, because it wasn't only criminals who were using these structures, it was also the private fund industry. And that example is, I think, a very telling one about the nervousness of politicians to try and restrain the golden goose, which is laying all these lovely golden eggs for us.
Thank you. Charles.
Thank you very much. Charles Godfrey from the Oxford Martin School. The Suez crisis brutally showed just how powerless the UK was compared with the States in the mid-50s. Why didn't the American authorities insist that the British authorities cut down the embryonic euro dollar market? And if I can slip in a second question, in the book you leave Dmitry Firtash fighting extradition in Vienna, and from what you've just said, he's still there. Is that changing, especially with Austria's changing attitude to Russia?
Thank you. With regard to the first question in the Eurodollar market, it took quite a long time for the Americans to notice it was happening. It took a long time for the British government to notice it was happening. The Bank of England kept it very much to themselves for quite a long time. If you spend time in the Bank of England archives, you can see these letters in which they're saying, you know, they're not in so many words, don't tell the Treasury, but there's very much the implication. But what's interesting is talking to people who were in the Treasury at the time, they were very, very different places, the Bank of England, even though it had been nationalised, it was culturally substantially the same as it had been pre-war and going all the way back. So it was public school, very suspicious of university-educated people, dominated by people who had worked for the merchant banks, particularly that class of the city, not the city more broadly, not the clearing banks, specifically the merchant banks, very public school. This you can see this, you see it in the letters, they all call each other by their first names. So the out-group are all called by their surnames. And there's this guy, Geoffrey Bell, who became the first person to genuinely research the Eurodollar market. And he was from, he'd been educated at a grammar school in Lincolnshire and been educated at the LSE.
So he was Bell.
He was Bell, so Dear Bell. And he would sign his letters heroically, Geoffrey, and would write Dear Charles. And they'd always write Dear Bell. So the British government didn't realise for a long time this was happening. And the US government didn't realize. And I think why they then tolerated it, sort of when they first learned about it in the early 60s, was because this is a period of sort of growing globalization. And it was kind of annoying for multinational companies to have these restrictions on moving money, because it meant that they really struggled to move money between different divisions of themselves. So say Shell Oil, for example, was really struggling to move dollars between its own divisions. It would have to fund, you know, its divisions in a country with the revenue in that country, which was quite hard. Initially, I think they quite liked the fact that there was this loophole in the regulations that allowed their multinationals to move money through London, because it kind of took the pressure off the US economy. It was only by the end of the 60s when, because there's this, sorry, I mean, going briefly very nerdy, in sort of international money flows, you have this trilemma of the three options. You can either have governmental autonomy, fixed exchange rates, or free capital flows. You can only have two of them. And if you have fixed exchange rates, which they wanted, all fixed against the dollar and the dollar fixed against gold, and governmental autonomy, you couldn't have free capital flows because that would destroy fixed exchange rates. So what London gave, it gave the world free capital flows. So one of the other two had to give, which is why by the end of the 60s you get this very high inflation in the US. And so the dollar has to come off gold in 1971. So this very high inflation is essentially the blowback of the creation of the offshore dollar market, because it meant that money could move freely and you ended up with this explosive growth in the money supply. And so by the end of the 60s, the US government hates this. And, you know, and the Fed is talking about trying to impose its own rules on the Eurodollar market, to which the answer from the Eurodollar market was, yeah, try us. You know, because, you know, they tried to office, they tried to open an office of the controller of the currency in London. And the Brits were like, by all means, you know, yeah, do what you like, open an office, which doesn't mean anything. So you know, but essentially the genie was out of the bottle by the time the Americans realized how damaging it was going to be. Initially, they thought it was quite convenient.
We have a question in the back.
It's a fascinating issue, though. I don't know why it hasn't had more attention, actually, because it's such a... Oh, sorry, Firtash. Yeah, he's still there. I don't think... I mean, it's become one of these extradition trials, like the Assange case, which just goes on and on and on and on. And essentially, it's like almost everyone's terrified of making a decision. What's weird is that I have a source, an American source that I quote in the book, who was telling me about why they chose to unseal the indictment when he was in Vienna. Because the only countries he went to were Ukraine, with whom there was no extradition treaty, Britain, France, and Austria. And because of the Assange case, and there was one of the 9/11 connected cases, which had gone on for so long, the extradition case, they didn't want to unseal it when he was in the UK. France is even less likely to extradite people to the US than Britain is. So the only other choice they had was Austria. They didn't particularly want it to be Austria, it was just the least bad option. So they were hoping that Austria would be less bad than the UK or France, which probably is, to be fair. But it's still not great from the perspective of trying to get a quick decision on an extradition case from an oligarch. It's always going to take a long time.
I think
Thanks. I'm Bridget from the Said Business School.
Hello.
They're going back to the topic of the butlers themselves. There was a very funny moment in March when some lawyers from Mishkan Dereya, the law firm that you mentioned, were called by name on the floor of Parliament as a sort of who's who of who is enabling these Russian fortunes to, you know, to be used in problematic ways in the context of Ukraine. At the same time, Mishkan Dereya was also a registered B corporation that has since been rescinded, but it was a B corporation is a legal status after rigorous application and scrutiny where you're meant to have a benefit to society. So it's often consumer goods, like for those of you who have kids, Ella's Foods, those little squeezy pouches, B corporation. I think you know, a lot of alternatives to dairy products, those are B corporations. So, you know, these kind of hippie products, I think Ben & Jerry's is a B Corp, right? But so is Mishkan Dereya. So my question, although that's since been rescinded, but my question is, clearly the right hand is not quite speaking to the left hand in terms of forms of social praise or forms of scrutiny that are applied to the butlers themselves. What's a way to address that? Is it about naming and shaming? Is that MP did on the floor? Is it simply about having more regular news stories? I'm wondering if the approach to the butlers themselves needs to be different than the approach to the oligarchs.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I mean, the core thing we need to do is prosecute people who enable financial crime. It doesn't happen. You know, if at the moment, even if there is a case brought against a big company for paying bribes, invariably the company settles with a deferred prosecution agreement or occasionally an actual conviction, but individual directors or executives are never found guilty. That is a real problem, and a problem in our law, but also a problem with the ambition of our law enforcement agencies. But more broadly, I mean, I'm full of admiration for Mishkan Dereya. They are very, very good at what they do. You know, they are, interestingly, well, anyway, I'm not going to go into that because they might sue me, but they are a very, very good law firm, as are Carter Ruck, as are all of these firms. They're very, very good at what they do. I've had a fascinating couple of conversations recently with a lawyer who works for a different law firm, and that law firm was retained by a Ukrainian oligarch to prevent a film I made about corruption in Ukraine from being shown in 2015. And it was very difficult at the time for me and the people who I work with making this film. We'd really gone to town in Ukraine. We're really proud of the work we'd done. This British law firm was retained by a Ukrainian oligarch to prevent us from showing the film, and successfully. No one would touch it after the letters started going out. And I don't know if you're a Game of Thrones fan, but Arya Stark, whenever she goes to bed, has a list of people she recites who she's going to kill. And if I'd had an Arya Stark list, the particular lawyers who'd killed this film would have been very near the top of it, because I was so angry and humiliated by what they'd done. It was awful because, you know, all these people in Ukraine had really risked their, you know, they'd risked a lot to talk to us, and we didn't. There was nothing to show for it. No film ever resulted. Anyway, 3 months ago, after the sanctions were imposed on the first Russian oligarchs, I got an email saying, would you take part in a webinar about sanctions? And it was from this law firm. And I was like, what on earth are you thinking? Like, you know, and I replied and said, you know, do you not remember? I mean, listen, I'll take part in your webinar, but I promise you, I'm going to talk at some length about what you did to my film. And the guy was like, what are you talking about? What film? What, you know? And I was like, and so I forwarded him the first letter we'd received with the private and confidential letter, all this spiel, this nonsense about all the, you know, various, you know, articles of the European Convention of Human Rights are violated or whatever. Anyway, and he was like, God, that's interesting. Yeah, I joined the firm after that happened, but I'll put you in touch with the person who wrote that letter, and maybe, you know, maybe you could come to some kind of arrangement. I'm like, it's very unlikely, but all right. And I went out for a cup of coffee with the lawyer who'd written this letter, and it was fascinating. I mean, she was lovely, really nice, and in fact had quite a similar background to me, also a Russophile, also lived in Russia for a bit, and spoke Russian and all that, but had just gone on a very different path. And what was interesting about it was, I think we have this vision of the enablers as being like Scrooge McDuck, you know, cackling in a room somewhere and, you know, diving into their vault full of gold coins. But she saw that she was doing the right thing. She didn't see that she wasn't, I will work for this oligarch to suppress the freedom of speech of this journalist. No, she was representing her client who was being unfairly traduced by an irresponsible journalist and used the tools available to her to do the right thing. And it was amazing and a fascinating discussion. I think it really opened my eyes to what the enabler culture is. It's not a culture of ha ha ha. It's people doing the right thing. And it's actually, I found it, I've actually met up with her another time and it was great. I really enjoyed talking to her in a sort of wow way. And it really opened my eyes. One thing I try and remember all the time is that there are very few actual villains in the world. That there are psychopaths, but leaving them aside, the vast majority of people think they're the heroes. And the vast majority of people think they're doing the right thing. And by their own rights, maybe they are. Maybe they're protecting their family, or they're protecting their clients, or they're protecting whoever. And it doesn't really help to think, this is a villain, because then you're just misunderstanding how someone sees themselves. And then you're never going to get inside their head and change their behavior. So, I mean, the question, I suppose, for me, and it's also one of those very self-serving arguments, we need more journalism, I'm a journalist, we need more revealing of what the victim's stories are, so you can understand, that if someone has been natural resources minister and inexplicably simultaneously built up a very successful natural resources company, that's not a risk-free and a cost-free process. Someone paid for that, and that person is the victim, and that's the stories that we need to tell.
There's a question from the online audience, Clara.
So Paul online asks, what is the likelihood of the money that has been sanctioned from the oligarchs to be used to help Ukraine in the future?
I mean, the future is a long time, Paul. I would say that the likelihood is, the probability is not zero, but it's very near, it trends to zero. There have been very few successful confiscations of assets which have been stolen by kleptocrats or oligarchs in the past. There have been some in relation to Sani Abacha in Nigeria, but they had to do some pretty complicated deals with his family to get those even. There have been some in relation to Kazakhstan, but even that was a bit of an exception. I think a far more telling example is the case of Pavlo Lazarenko, a former prime minister of Ukraine, who after he fell out with the government, made the mistake of flying to America, where he was immediately arrested. And they prosecuted him, put him in jail for corruption. He was in jail for, I think, 8 years. And they confiscated his fortune, or they tried to confiscate his fortune. But as far as I know, they still haven't managed to get hold of it. That was in, I think he was arrested in 2000 or 2001. And they've been trying to confiscate his fortune for 2 decades, and they still haven't managed it. It is so well protected by offshore structures and lawyers that they haven't managed to get hold of it. And so these court cases become a kind of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. They just end up being job creation schemes for lawyers. And no money ever actually ends up being returned, or very, very rarely. And then you have the issue of, if the money is returned, as it has been in examples in Nigeria, how do you know that the money isn't just going to be stolen by someone else? It's a real challenge. There's some farcical example with Equatorial Guinea, where the Obiang family, the Obiang Jr. had a mansion in California. He had a very large and exciting collection of Michael Jackson memorabilia, a series of supercars and various other things. And then the American government brought a case against this as the proceeds of crime, confiscated it. And then what do you do with it? Because if you return it to Equatorial Guinea, it's just going to go straight back to the guy you've just confiscated it from. He owns everything. So it's a real challenge.
We only have 5 minutes left, and I see 7 or 8 questions in the audience. We won't be able to take all of them. I suggest that we take 3 questions, which will roll up in one go, and Oliver, you get the final say. I see a hand over there, and then another hand there, and one here in the front. And I suggest those of you who still have questions that you can ask them directly to Oliver in the drinks next door.
Hi, thanks very much. My name is Rachel Morrow. I'm doing my doctorate in international development. And as a South African, I'm very conscious of the suffering that happens when corrupt politicians can shift their money overseas. My question is, I think you mentioned that there's a chapter in the book about what civilians can do and what we can do, and I'd be interested to hear that, but also what the international community can do. I mean, is there a space for United Nations or, I mean, Biden's been doing this sort of 15% minimum tax. Is there some kind of equivalent G20 something that can happen? Is there some international context in which this can really be tackled? Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Peter Berkman, the chair of Oxford for Europe. And we use the hashtag Russia bought Brexit, which you might want to comment on. But my question really was to do with the case of Arron Banks versus Carol Cadwalader. And I know it's a sensitive area, and I'm sure you'll be very careful about what you can say. But do you have any comments and any lessons to be learned from it?
Thank you. And finally, here.
Wait.
We're sitting in Oxford, so very briefly, Oxford University gets the largest of all the donations of all universities in Britain, largest in two or three in the world. If you want to recognize them, look up and down. They have tall buildings and centers and a new college. I'd identify six of whom three made their fortunes in Russian aluminium mining. What are they giving all this money for? The naming price in Oxford is 80 million, not these billions. The highest gift recently is 175 million. So what are they giving all this money away for? Where they get out of it? And doesn't matter anyway.
Thank you. Oliver, if you just want to deal with these questions within 3 minutes, I know it's difficult.
What can governments do? Is there a role for the UN? I spoke to the guy who penned the UN Convention Against Corruption in the 1970s. He rather naively wrote a very concise, well-worked-out convention on corruption, and then it was submitted to the governments, and all hell broke loose. The communist bloc wanted to define corruption as capitalism, the Arab bloc wanted to combine corruption as Zionism, and so it went on. His sort of rather concise document sprawled to hundreds of pages and then never really came to anything at all. No one really knows what corruption is, right? I mean, it's just it isn't a defined word. So one of the issues is that one thing I would love to see from academics while we're here is, you know, proper work to look at corruption, to define it, to how it works, its typographies. What the bit in Britain, the laundering of the money, is that still corruption or should we call that something else? At the moment, it's like we have cancer specialists with only the word cancer to describe all the different kinds of cancer. You know, we need to separate it out and, you know, dissect out all the different bits to define how it works. Because at the moment, the word is so vague, it's very difficult to know what it means. As for Carol Cadwalader's case, it's a disgrace. I mean, the fact that she was left alone and not backed up by the Observer is a disgrace. Mm. The fact that our court system subjected anyone to that is a disgrace. It's great that she won. I'm delighted. But it is a demonstration of how our court system benefits people who are able to afford to use it. And it isn't an instrument for justice. It's an instrument for vengeance. I'm delighted that she won. But it should never have happened in the first place, is what I think about that. As for what's the money for, well, like I was saying, they want to be aristocrats, right? And as I was saying, they don't think of themselves as bad people, right? They're entrepreneurs. So what do entrepreneurs do with their money? You know, they spend it on this. And also, and this is not a flippant response, if you've got $8 billion, it's actually quite hard to spend it. It's a lot of money, right? And it keeps building up. It backs up all the time, the interest on the interest. You know, it's just getting it out the door is a challenge. I mean, not everyone can be Mackenzie Scott. And she chucks it out by the $500 million loan. You know, if you're just, you know, and you want to have a bit of money for the super yachts and stuff, but you're still going to be backing up, you know, buying a big house. There's only so many big houses you can have. Once you've got four or five, you're going to struggle to visit them every year. You could buy an island, but again, same. A big donation to a university, it's immortality, isn't it? You know, what's it? There's this line, you know, we die three times, you know, once when we die, once when the last person who knew us died, and once when our name is said for the last time. You know, if you're Cecil Rhodes and you've got your statue up there, you know, know, then people are going to keep talking about you. You know, what was it you said after when he was dying? But they don't change the name of countries, do they? You know, I mean, they do, as it turned out. But you know, if you've got a school of governance named after you, and no implication against the person who that's named after, then you know, then it's immortality.
Oliver, this has been fascinating, eye-opening, and very disquieting. Thank you very much for joining us here today. Thank you.